Oh, and we also have Jim Quick from Northwest on the telephone.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
We're going to try and get back into the swing of things. We've had a little break now and
can't remember where we are.
Don't remember where we are and what we're doing, so we'll trudge our way through it today and see where we're at. Boy, last time we finally got through all the requirements for the... Third-party reviewer, wasn't it?
Yeah. I'll kind of tell you what I've been up to in the last month, if that can help launch us.
Sure.
I had a plethora of comments, more than usual, from the last couple of meetings, and I kind of did some catch-up. Shivana caught a few things that I hadn't caught up on yet, and I got those in there. I think I got the final list. I got that last email from you. So I think this pretty much includes everything. If I wasn't sure, I made a note or I left it in highlight. So what you see in highlight, I'm not certain that the subcommittee has sort of finally given it its blessing. So that's what the highlight means.
Okay.
And I miscommunicated a little bit. And the draft you've got, which is dated August 17th.
Yeah.
Oh, that one. Okay. It's on Corey paper,
right?
Which is really helpful to color. Like now, it stands out, and differences in color.
Good. Well, we got that part right. Here's the color part we didn't get right. I actually have, and if you look at it carefully, you'll note that there's two slightly different shades
of
gray.
You're talking shades of gray now.
One is yellow, and one is blue.
You have to decide. One is kind of a light orange, one is kind of a brighter, though. But... yeah, we just put it on gray paper. So anyway, but everywhere where I have a comment or a note, and that's either a question to the subcommittee or maybe some notes from me or, in a couple of cases, notes from planning commission members, because we did a workshop with them, so some of the concerns or things that they responded, I want to kind of separate that out from the subcommittee's work.
Right.
So we know where it's coming from and who's saying it. I usually did identify who's saying what. I think I noted William C.C. in here on a couple of things where Shivana had highlighted that was their comments. So I tried to identify who was sort of the source of the note. And then the slightly darker shade is new language that, for one reason or another, maybe it goes to a different spot, maybe we want to take another look at it, maybe it's just not finally final. So that's what you've got in 17 pages of the ordinance as it stands right now. Rather than calling these number of drafts, I just put a date on it.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't get caught up in the number of drafts.
Mm-hmm.
Dates are easier for me. I also did...
we may have to go to a color legend.
Don't start with me. I also did, just made copies of this, so kind of a cheat sheet, because it's 17 pages long now. This is a outline. Remember last time, Vivian had some concerns, and I think Shivana too, in talking about how to reorder things so they made more sense. There were a few comments on that.
I didn't care how they ordered it.
I didn't care how they ordered it.
Here's the order it's in. Here's your cheat sheet, so you can go right to it.
I think Vivian was most concerned about that.
Yeah. I'm happy with it.
As long as it's an order that you, because you're going to implement it, you need to have a better order than I need to have an order.
The other thing that I made a copy of for you is, and we had talked about this a couple of meetings ago, and it's here under item 2D on the agenda, is decision matrix. So I can hand it out now if you want to have it, but we'll discuss it when we get to 2D in the agenda. In other words, when something comes in, here's basically the flow chart we go through to make a decision. And we'll we'll get to that under agenda item 2D.
This is great.
So, and that's just a visual to help you kind of walk through. So if we want to talk about differences in process, procedure, you understand how it is that James and I are going to look at applications when they come in. We can refer to that during this portion of this meeting and kind of know what we're
talking about. And Jim's got a copy of them. So
and Jim will get a copy of that. I don't think we've emailed it to him yet.
No, but I will email that to him later today.
Thank you, Ann.
You're welcome.
All right. And you're familiar with permit processes anyway, so the language probably isn't going to throw you. So, and then the other thing you have in your packet today is what James worked on, which is standards for co-location. That's item 2A on the agenda, and James is going to talk about that. We also have some things on the table here. Never let it be said we weren't keeping the paper industry in business. How many copies of this did you make?
I just made one
just
of each.
One. Okay.
One of each photo.
Okay. These are examples that we can look at that are just examples of mitigating visual impacts, screening, make it look like a tree, make it look like a church steeple, something like that. Pull them off the internet. And one of the things I'd like to talk about is something that was required in a couple of jurisdictions I've worked for, which is the applicant doing some sort of visual stimulation of the cell tower itself. And whether that's a place we want to go or not, we can discuss that, but this is a company that does that. They essentially will show you, here's what the site looks like without, here's what it looks like with. And we can actually, at least for the members here in the room, we can actually go to a computer, go to the website, and show you. And I think, Ann, did you include the link? Bottom of the page, maybe?
No, I did not.
Okay.
You sent that to us,
didn't
you?
I did.
That's right. I sent it
yes.
to their website.
Yes.
Yeah, kind of cool. Okay.
Yeah.
So you can just kind of see.
Because I think Siobhan had, or it was Vivian that had a question on, she said it was very cool and she wanted to know, I think she was curious about cost or other. She wanted to explore a little more.
Right. I don't think cost is a very big factor in that.
I don't know, but we can call one of the companies that does it and ask them what it costs. And if there's anybody local that does it, or close to local, because it may not be.
There isn't anyone that I know of. There isn't. I contacted one of them because we wanted to put some of the what they use for coating outside the antennas. Because the stuff that they use is supposed to be anti-ice, anti-snow type stuff. And one of the quotes I got back for one of our sector antennas, I could pay a technician to climb the tower 100 times to just go chip ice off the antenna versus what they want for the coating. That's just for the coating stuff. I don't know about the tower and stuff.
But there was a visual impact, that was for other reasons.
Well, it was basically so you make it look like the same stuff that they use for making a cover tree.
I see. Okay. All right. I'm confused because I thought we were referencing that when they bring in the application, they bring in just a picture or a visual indicator.
A visual simulation of what it was.
With the tower, without a tower,
yeah.
Not an actual.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Right. And some of those visual representations happen to be stealth towers.
Right, exactly.
Some of them aren't.
Okay.
Some of them are just, here's what it looks like, here's what the site looks like without it, and what the site looks like with it. So,
computer generated.
So,
that shouldn't be a big issue.
Right.
I think that's a pretty good
option. We can talk about that and maybe go look at the computer after at the end of the meeting so you can see what they look like if you haven't had a chance.
But their stealth stuff looked real cool, though.
So, it
did look nice.
Yeah. So, anyway, those are the materials we have. Also, Paul Slotemaker had sent me this article. The big question, why do we need more cell sites? A white paper which was prepared for municipal governments by Andrew Siebold of Outlook Mobility, Outlook for Mobility from Santa Barbara. And so since Paul sent that to me and asked that it be available to the committee members, we'll get some copies here. We can email it to you or you can take a hard copy. So, that's all the paperwork.
There's one more piece that I included. Because you handed out some things regarding property values last time, I also handed out a packet.
Okay. Did I go out via email? Or
no, just now.
Okay. Do I have a copy? And do I have a copy?
You should. It should be in your pile.
Know.
If it's not, I've got extras right here.
I have no idea if you have.
You're supposed to know what I have.
Now you have a copy.
I'm really sorry what I have. So, that's what we have for you in terms of items for the agenda and background.
James?
All right.
Let's make some progress today.
Okay, co-location. Do you want to pull up that little handout I made up? 8-10-11 section draft co-location. It was one meeting ago or two meetings ago. We were talking and going through the ordinance, and there was discussion. You know what? We need to have a co-location section. So a section in the handout specifically addresses co-location. The original draft from the staff report had it in there. From the very beginning, and I kind of went through my big binder, kind of went up through it, and then all of a sudden it disappeared. It did disappear. And so basically what I did is I just recaptured that same language that was done in the very beginning, brought it here again. Okay, let's maybe, I read through it, I think it's very workable. I think it was well written, and it looks like I even found some information that Shivana had submitted regarding it, and I made some notes on the second page. It actually has some of the recommendations, additions that the committee can look at to see if they want to add to it. Nothing real different here. It was here in the beginning. It just disappeared for a while. I would like to see it come back. It just makes things a lot easier when we do co-locations. A separate section.
If you could help me understand, because I mean, this looks great to me, because you passed it out last time, too, so I was able to look at it. Where I'm getting confused is the things that go to in this, the things that go to ministerial review. Do all of those, right now, the things that go to ministerial review, well, that's even up for grabs, because I have a comment on that, but it includes temporary facilities, for sure.
Temporary facilities.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. And includes co-locations.
Includes this. It would include this.
Right. So even just stopping there, so where does something like temporary facilities have standards? Or is this really
general
standards?
General development standards.
General development standards?
Yeah.
Yeah. 99040, review type. Temporary wireless communications, so we subject to ministerial review of compliance with the general development standards.
Under 9960.
So it looks like temporary facilities have the least criteria. Is that accurate? Because co-location has also these, and a new site has a whole bunch of additional.
Temporary one. Temporary would be...
And I'd like to define temporary also, and how many times it can be renewed and still be considered temporary.
Tess, how often do you see temporary facilities?
Never. Every once in a while, like Samac, they put on a big thing out there once a year. So I know of twice that US Cellular has allowed an antenna to be put up on their tower for 3 days for them to do what they need to do, so they have communications out there at Lake Samac, and then a week later the antenna is taken down.
Is that for emergency purposes?
No, it's so that the people who are doing whatever gathering it is there, that they have internet access.
I see.
So they can do their sign-ups and print out their stuff. Let people have access to the web. And we do the same thing for the barter fair every year. But we go out to there. It's just what we do is just like we would be setting up a client. We set up one of our antennas for them to access the tower. And they use it for 2 days, and then they bring it back to us. And we don't mount any, you know, we don't dig any dirt. We don't, you know, actually do anything that changes the environment or anything.
Right.
Most of the time, what you're doing is you're basically setting up a temporary site for people to use whatever service that's provided for that area. And then once they're done with it, they remove the equipment and it's gone.
So the event itself, or the
mainly
the circumstance itself, is temporary.
Yes, exactly.
Would it also be for any repair of a facility that some major structural component was being replaced, and so you put a temporary thing?
We just went through that.
Okay.
We had one of our links between our towers decided to go belly up on us, and while we're waiting on new equipment to come in, we had to put a temporary antenna up in order to restore functionality to the tower, and that was there for about 3 weeks while waiting on the equipment. And then once the new equipment came in, we put the government took the temporary down.
Would it be fair to say that? Local question, but
well, before you get to that,
what's the time frame like between when you figured you need a temporary facility and it needs to go up? Because part of my thinking was that the ministerial permit happens faster than a quasi-judicial permit.
It is
noticeably everything is different.
It is literally hours when it. Once we found the issue. The issue that we were going through, the tower was down. No internet to the tower, so we had to come up with something quickly to restore functionality to the tower, to get bandwidth to the tower. So we were really under the gun to get something there to work, to restore those clients, because those clients had no service until we repaired that link.
Well, that was part of my perception to put temporary in. And I don't think temporary was in your original ordinance. That was in the ordinance that I worked on in Vancouver, Washington. So when I had heard stories like that, something goes up, it comes down pretty quick, we heat it up pretty quick, we're covering an emergency gap, or
the longest they've ever.
I think it was actually because wireless communications in our police department at that time was switching over. They wanted to be able to put up a tower in a couple of places to test their new system, and they had a new system of radios or something. They wanted to be able to access this one portion of town. So they went through a full site plan review. While they had the system up, at least they wanted access so they could use their radios in a whole. So I remember the kind of the quick response issue, and that's why I put it in here as ministerial.
The longest that I would say is when they have fires, because could be a couple months. But still, it's when the fire's gone, the camp's cleaned out and everybody's gone. But when they had the biscuit fire, they were out at Telmac. That was the fire camp, and they just put a freaking structure right in the middle of the camp. And lit up right there.
That was one of the things USA allowed them to put a receiver up on their tower.
One thing that I didn't write into this was how temporary is temporary?
That's and can it be renewed?
You're pretty good.
As another temporary, can it be renewed? Okay, that 6 weeks is over. We want to renew for a new temporary.
Yeah.
Or how many times can it be renewed?
Part of the problem is
some temporal.
You're dealing with
parameters.
We were at the mercy of our vendor. The equipment that we needed was on back order. And we were waiting and waiting and waiting. Finally, I got tired of waiting, and I found the equipment that I needed, the P forms that I needed, I found them on eBay. I had no choice. I wasn't going to wait another 2-3 weeks for the company to say, okay, we now have them to sell to you. And I went ahead and ordered, got them off eBay, ordered them overnight, the next day, had the new stuff up, and we're back up to where we need to be.
Let me ask a question of James here, who's issued more temporary permits in this for other uses in this county than I have. We do a ministerial review process. How fast does it turn around? Let's say Taz calls you tomorrow and says, hey, I just got a tower fall down. I've got a carrier that wants to put up a temporary facility on a wooden pole, telephone pole or something like that, and I need to get it up for 3 weeks at least.
You know, really depending on the issue, we could probably do this quicker today. If there's more things involved, the tower's really tall, and there's a lot of structure to it, it could be a week.
Right.
Somewhere in that range.
Okay.
Now, could they put some sort of an exemption in here, not for a structure, but let's say that you need to, let's say your tower, you've got your tower been approved, and all the equipment on the tower is. It's all in your site plan, and everyone knows what's there. And let's say for whatever reason you're having an issue with one of your signals, could you put some sort of a temporary exemption into it to say, okay, well, I'm going to call you up and say, look, we've got this 2-foot radome antenna on this tower, and we're not getting the throughput that we need. to this other site. We need to put a 3-foot antenna up to see if that's going to fix our problem. And as long as we don't go over 5 days or something, we can do that. And then if that works, then we can come down and get the permit to leave it up. Is it? The reason why I say that is because that happened to us.
Not to be able to test it before.
To be able to test a piece of equipment before we actually pay to have a permit for it. And then we know that that does work, then hey, look, we'll come down and say, look, we're going to replace it with this piece right here. Here's the engineering saying that the power can handle it, and we're ready to go forward with that.
I haven't even addressed it, but I'd ask the chair to maybe take that under consideration and test if you want to send me some language where I can work on language and just tackle it next time. I mean,
that's right. Something
we don't have we don't have anything in our code right now that's sort of a test function anything that I'm aware of.
No. See, but in the electronics industry, it's a very common tool.
Right.
Yeah. I'm not saying that we should do anything to circumvent any of the rules or regulations. I'm just saying that we can put it up to. It happened to me last winter. I had a 2-foot dish, and my signal just went to snot. We replaced it with a 3-foot dish. And it our functionality went back to normal.
But you're saying if the permit had been for the 2-foot, you'd like the opportunity to test the 3-foot
exactly.
Before you have to go
so
back.
So because I ordered the dish,
and
I
have a testing notification or something like that. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
It's good for a week.
Which is kind of temporary. It's kind of that
exactly.
Falls in a way.
It's a temporary thing, so we know that that's going to work before we go through the process of applying for the permit.
But that's
What's the outside time limit of temporary?
I'd say 14 days.
14 days.
I'd say no more than 14 days because if we can't figure out within 14 days if that equipment's going to work, then we need to go get another lab order. Seriously. Normally we're going to know within a day or two, depending on weather conditions. Depending on your frequency and whether or not it's a licensed piece of equipment that you're running, what your EIRP is, depends on what you're going to be able to shoot through. So, obviously, going with a bigger antenna, you get more power out of it, so you can go through more obstacles. But going from a 2-foot to a 3-foot dish actually increased our dB by almost 40%. It was about 20 dB gain we got.
Right.
So it was a significant increase for us.
Right. But there's some cost associated with that, obviously.
You
don't need to go there, you're not going to pay for it. So. Okay.
Isn't
so some sort of notification. What's that?
For testing purposes, prior to section 99.120 in the grade version, or for testing purposes prior to completion. Oh, that's prior to completion of construction. That's not changing.
Right.
Excuse me. Yeah.
So he's referencing either a repair or a test versus the installation.
What are you reading that?
99.120, page 15 of gray at the bottom. Temporary uses. I was looking under the temp. Now it's its own section.
Actually,
but this timeline says it's 30 days after it's no longer needed, so that doesn't limit how long.
Yeah. Now, maybe that could be just edited.
It's been removed. It's not operating for more than 60 days commencement of transmission procedure. So, yeah. What you're talking about is.
Yeah,
it's really something other than a ministerial temporary use. It's a notification, I think, pretty tight time frame.
Right.
14 days.
If you're in the industry and you can't figure out if that's going to work within that time frame, then obviously go get another line of work. So.
Okay. Make sure that under.
That makes a lot of sense. Because I know in my business, we have machines go down all the time, and we just grab another machine and wheel it in while we work on that one.
Right.
And a lot of times, if you have a part fail, you may not necessarily have the exact same part as what was there. You may have something that newer technology, or maybe even older technology, for that matter. We've actually had to do that from time to time.
Okay. So what we'd be looking at, probably, just structurally in the ordinance, would be a subsection of 99.040 and review types that would be a notification rather than an actual permit.
Right.
The ordinance still controls.
Exactly.
Right. But since James and I don't have a permit that we're issuing.
Right.
Some sort of notification from a carrier.
We'll call you up and say, look, we've had this fail. We'd like to try this. If it works, we'll go down and do the permit for it within 14 days.
Something like that.
Yeah, it works.
So some language and all.
So this temporary uses section, which is new, so I haven't looked at it before, it does have a limit, 60 days, but then it would be good to say it's non-renewable, because you wouldn't want the loophole of a temporary thing which bypasses some of our standards to be then renewed as a temporary and then renewed as a temporary.
No, I'm not talking
yours is fine. That's not addressing that.
You're talking about the other one.
I'm talking about the other one, yes.
Temporary wireless communication facilities shall operate for not more than 60 days commencement of transmission from such facility begins. That seems pretty concrete to me.
So let's say they finish and then It's not listed though.
This is.
Okay, I'm missing it. Oh yes, there it is. Okay, so temporary is under that, and then temporary. Just like my head said. So what standards apply to a temporary?
General development standards. 060, right there in the statement.
The general development
standards. And because it's temporary, we're not putting it through site plan approval criteria. We'll talk about visual mitigation here in a minute. But, yeah, it's ministerial, fairly fast, can be done over the counter. For the tower that's down, it's not a 14-day test notification we're talking about. The tower is down, it's going to take 2 months to replace it. You got 60 days. But I guess my question for Taz is 60 days adequate?
But well, just like what we did, we were going to go with a different piece of equipment. And like I said, I went ahead and found something on eBay. If you really want to take care of your customers or your clients, you're going to do whatever is necessary to get it fixed.
Yeah.
So, and of course, U.S. Cellular and Verizon, all the guys, they've got deeper pockets than I have, so they'll just call the company and say, look, you give it to me now or I'll go buy it from someone else and the company's going to give it to them. So, it's 60 days should be fine.
I'm good. I thought 2 weeks was enough to restart the stop sign the other day, and that didn't happen. But anyway.
So on your ministerial again, just help me.
Okay.
Adding antenna to an existing sector array, does that mean it's the horizontal thing? Is that a sector array? What's a sector array?
Sector array, so you have your tower.
Yeah.
And then you, on most of your communication sites, they'll have three things like this that surround the tower. Here's the tower center. And then they'll have an antenna. Okay, all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
That's called the sector array.
And that's one company, so it's the same company.
That's normally if you see it hung together like this all the way around, that's one company. They're not going to allow someone to come in and put, because you're talking frequencies and you don't want someone else's. You want to separate your frequencies.
Right, so on different arrays.
Exactly.
So when you're talking about adding antenna to an existing sector array, it's obviously going to be the same person who's already got
most
that
likely
array.
The same person is most likely going to be the same make and model antenna, unless the company itself has done a mid-year production change, like Motorola just did to me. The antenna should look similar to the other antennas that are there. The internal working of the antenna is going to be the same. The outside shell might look a little bit different. Next time we have a meeting, I can show you what some of those antennas look like. I can bring a couple of them in. But yeah, normally if you see it all the way around at one height, that's only one company.
So you keep saying normally, and I'm always... I'm trying to make sure we don't have any loopholes.
Well, the reason I'm saying normally is that's...
So far.
That's the practice that we do. I don't want your antenna right next to mine. And I'm sure you don't want my antenna right next to yours. I just went through that with AT&T. They actually did a design flaw on what they put on for our new tower, and they put one of their antennas right next to mine, and I said, this isn't going to work. You need to move this antenna. I'm not going to allow it to go there. And it's not that I don't want to be nice and let them have that height of power. It's just that I don't want their frequency right next to mine, even though it's their frequencies are totally different than ours.
What can happen when they're that close? Can they?
It depends on how close together the frequencies are.
Right.
If I'm running 5.8 and you're running 5.7, depends on how wide the channel is. If you're running a 700 channel and I'm running a 300 channel, chances are I'm going to be over to you.
Because you're adding a 700 channel, increasing
then there's enough of that spectrum to where we can stay away from each other.
You see that?
Wow, that would have to be in the development.
Yeah, if it's there, then
if it's there, then it covers it. So that would be under the general development standard.
Lane 9060.
So what I just wanted to confirm that since adding additional antenna into a sector array is ministerial, I just wanted to make sure that some of the standards it's subject to, which would have to be in general development standards, requires some documentation that adding more antenna doesn't go over the allowed FCC total emissions.
Gotcha.
Because we're adding antenna now.
It should lower it.
That would be great.
You have to understand is the more antennas you put up there, the less power you're going to generate. Because you have non-overlapping channels in any given frequency. 2.4 gig has 3 non-overlapping channels. You have 11 different channels you can use, but you have different groups that do not overlap. So if I put up 4 of those 2.4 gigs on one tower on 490-degree sector antennas, I'm going to have to run what's called an AB configuration or an ABCA configuration because I've only got 3 non-overlapping channels. So I have to separate those channels so that each antenna next to it, they're not running within that the allotted width of that channel width, so I don't create interference for myself. So you have to separate your channels a lot. So if you go and say, okay, well, I'm going to change that. I'm not going to run 90-degree sectors. I'm going to run 60-degree sectors. Well, you now have a bigger problem because you still only have 3 non-overlapping channels, and you have all these antennas that you have to try to work together with each other. So one thing is lower your gain.
Yeah, it's a little bit beyond me. I hear you. It's a little bit beyond me.
So the thing is I don't want to have to put up more towers if I don't have to. I'd much rather be able to change the equipment I have.
On the sector array, change the antennas or add antennas or something.
Exactly.
Like that.
It's going to be a lot more cost effective.
Let me give you a frame of reference.
Right. So you got
a fire hose that puts so much water out that you can add 6 regular garden hoses and get the same amount of output by adding more. So you have less power, less push of the water, but you're still getting the same achievement. So it's a good frame of reference for understanding.
The other thing you might want to also look at is
I'm happy.
The other thing is that they do like is the more towers they have, the less power that they have to use to cover the same amount of area, because this tower doesn't have to transmit 6 miles, it only has to transmit 3 miles because you've got this tower over here that's going to cover that gap from.
Yeah, he just pointed out. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
I think we're covered.
You're covered. Right. Yeah. Well, a couple wording things. I don't know. It's just little wording things on this one. I don't know if you want them.
Steve, too. It's funny. Yeah,
well, Steve's not here. Okay, if they're quick, go ahead.
Steve, the for applications, the co-location of additional antennas and or cellular PCS equipment in or on existing facilities, because facilities is like the equipment shelter.
Where are you? Is this on Jam's co-location?
Yeah. Okay. These are really minor, first page, A, application.
I think
if you're talking about facilities, it's on a support structure, it's in a facility. It's not on a facility, it's like an equipment.
So change the word on to in.
No, both. In or on.
In slash on.
Okay, good enough. That's a typo we
can accept. Number 2, we're changing tower to support structure because it could be something other than a tower. Fifth word in the sentence on number 2. Remember?
Okay.
Support structure instead of a tower. 4A, support structure, not power structure. And that's it for the little things until we get to the notes.
Okay, that's pretty good. James, did you have anything else?
Not that I can see. The only thing I'll point out is we just have to find, me and David need to find
a,
kind of left it open on where these could fit into the...
There was one more support structure in number 5.
Right there.
Okay.
Sorry. So this is likely going to be...
Caught number 5, same thing, tower, change the support structure.
Okay.
In number 5.
Okay.
James was just pointing out to me, he didn't have this numbered because he and I were actually had vacations back to back, so we didn't speak to each other for a couple of weeks.
My question might help.
So
I didn't know where this would fit in.
Where it's going to fit in is 99050B. And it's noted in your gray copy.
How dare you guys take vacations with something important going on?
And we have a third, you've got two notes from last week. I can comment on. We have
that's
a third
true.
Note also.
Mm-hmm. On the second page of that document, on the August 10th, the white page. Yes, correct. On the second page.
Page 2, performance.
I have notes down at the bottom. YMCAC proposed this additional language, and I
so,
threw them in here for you guys to discuss.
So the question is, does the requirement that's already in section 42.060 regarding site plan mapping include these things? Because if it already includes these things, then it's redundant. Because you're already saying that they have to do a...
But if you're going to do a co-location, too, you're not going to put in the drainage and wetlands and driveways, and that stuff's already going to be in existence. It's generally, a co-locate means... We co-locate off of Adar Mountain with Steve. I use one of his towers. I basically hang land myself on a tower, and I've got my IDUs inside this building, and that's it. We didn't change any of the ground. We didn't change the driveway. Of course, we'd love to get it. You guys should force them to pave that road when they pave all the roads. We need that to be a requirement.
Steve, not here. You can ask for any
I mean, I'm the same as you on this one, that I pulled this out of another...
Right,
another
I don't see this disagrees with co-location. I think this would be a new tower.
And where would
they but they're building the tower isn't changing, but the facility that's going to have all the ancillary things and the batteries and the generator and all that, they are still doing some building there, even a co-location. So some of these, I think, are relevant. They're still putting up something other than just antennas on the tower.
Normally we don't, because normally the stuff's already there.
But it's somebody else's.
Right.
A different company.
Yeah, but we pay them for use of that stuff. I use U.S. Cellular's generator. I use Steve's regular power. When the power goes out, US Cellular kicks in, and you know, so basically all I did was I paid him to be able to hang my stuff on his tower and rent for the little spot that I use.
Sure. That's that that's what they do.
And that's normally
with
what we do.
With a facility here with, you know, equipment shelters
all
that, and then the tower. That usually doesn't change in co-location.
No,
I don't think I've ever seen that.
Okay,
so
that's cool.
Now, the site plan is going to look like this. Here's the tower. Here's the equipment shed. Here's the equipment shed. And there may be an additional equipment shed put in here. But in terms of that parameter outside the real footprint,
now, if they have it put in a new equipment shed over an ox center, would that not be covered under a building permit?
Well, ministerial permit for co-location would identify that within it.
Right.
But, and if it helps define it better that we're not increasing the footprint, then that's maybe the language you're throwing there.
Yeah, well, if they increase the footprint, they're going to have to go back to the landowner and say, well, this is my land, therefore that's...
Then
you need another whole new permit altogether. Then, like,
right.
Okay.
Because then you're essentially...
Okay, we're not adamant about that one. Yeah, we're adamant about the 1 acre.
I think that really doesn't apply.
Okay. Cross that out? That's okay. Yeah, same process. But the 1 acre, we can't see any reason why we wouldn't include that.
And where would that go in terms of that?
Wherever James and...
I can't answer that because we're not subject to the EIA standards for... IT is not required to meet any of those standards. The problem is the IT market changes so fastly that it's tough. You know, you're going to end up changing on equipment every 2 years, and you're paying for either a license from the FCC or you know you're putting up this equipment. It's going to be real tough to do. Now, safety standards.
That's what it is. It's safety.
Are you talking as far as emissions go?
I don't think it's about emissions, because that doesn't change. That's FCC.
Well, all the equipment that we buy, the hardware is all regulated. You know, the mounting hardware, that's all regulated. They can't send us an antenna and a couple of zip ties and say, here you go, put this up on the tower. Besides, I'm not going to spend, I just spent $3,000 on a new antenna. I'm not going to put a $3,000 antenna up and use zip ties. You know, and it's just not worth it to me to put something up and have to worry about, okay, is that thing going to fall down on me?
So if you're already going to meet rigorous safety standards, then what could possibly be the objection from making a requirement that they meet the current safety standards? To protect the citizens.
The citizens shouldn't be within 100 feet of that tower. And if that piece of equipment falls off the tower, gravity's going to take over, it's going to fall straight down. It's not going to go outside that fenced area.
But help me understand, why would you
It's a cost
object?
Factor. For me, it's a cost factor for having to have someone else come in and re-stamp something that's already been stamped from the manufacturer when I bought it. That's the only objection I have.
But if it's new equipment, nobody says that the person has to re-examine the equipment. They can just say this equipment was recommended by the most recent EIA, TIA.
But if I have to go and have someone tell you that, and you're not going to take my word for it, then that's a cost factor for me. If I have to, I go and I buy the equipment from Motorola, and now I get the equipment, and now I have to go find this guy over here who's certified for him to look at it and say, hey, great, it's fancy, it's good.
So your concern is the certification, it's not that it meets the standards.
Right, no, I have no problem with the equipment meeting the standards.
Okay,
the problem is that I have to go to the secondary market to find someone to say, yeah, what they sold you is right.
So we're on page 9 of the latest draft. Great news. Top of the page.
Uh-huh. And we're still under development standards.
And that's under development standards, which co-locations are subject to. Are we there?
Okay.
All right. So, cross up.
Yep.
Are we about there on co-locations?
I have one more, but it's probably already there. So you're just going to show me where it's already. I'm sure it's there. Noise is in the general standards. I'm betting it is. Noise abatement.
And let me, I want to get this clarification in there because Stephen Tad will probably just be real appreciative of it. That when they do the standards, it's at the time the equipment is purchased, they're not going to have to replace it to.
Right. I understood that.
Okay. Just want to make sure that's noted.
I don't think you guys know this, Sean. I don't remember at all.
So then our only other thing is that there's something about description. Well, we have written down the description of methods for noise abatement of any noise-making equipment added to the site as a co-location. Because we weren't sure it was there, you know.
They would just have to meet the noise ordinance.
Put it in the general development standards about noise. You want to say some language on that?
Okay.
Yeah, it's up to me.
And
we already have a noise ordinance.
And if you can answer on it, since we know where we're going to put it.
So what are we
into 99.06 under general development standards. And we could.
Call it number U.
Is that the next
letter?
Letter U.
See, what are we worried about as far as noise? The generator is making too much noise?
The air conditioning when it goes on and off. Just that they have enough noise abatement.
It's kind of weird that we want the noise ordinance, and then okay, we want the safety issue. We don't want the hazardous material. So if they put a generator in, which is actually better than having the batteries there, then we're going to create more noise. If we have just the battery there, then we'll worry about the batteries.
But there's noise abatement. It's fine if there's noise. You just have to do what they do to take care of it.
Why should they be treated any different than a homeowner? if you're allowed to run something at your house, why should that be any different than what they're running?
Because it's a commercial enterprise, and they can afford to not.
Because they can afford to. That's
well, it's a commercial enterprise.
That's ridiculous.
If it's right next to somebody's.
Well, I have people live right next to me, and I can't control what they do. It's ridiculous.
Okay. I don't see it being much of an issue. We already have the noise in the development standards.
We have a general county noise ordinance, which is inadequate, and that's going to be dealt with, I think, in the next year or so.
Right. So if we do anything now, it's going to change when that changes.
Well, maybe, maybe not. But a general county noise ordinance is, you know, running your chainsaw at 3 o'clock in the morning. That's what it's focused on, that kind of stuff. And it's usually temporary stuff. I think the issue, and I don't want to belabor the point, but I think the issue for a facility like this and how it is different than general residential use and the way planners usually look at it when looking at ordinances is any use that's going to, you may have a compressor at your house, but if you're a business, you might have a compressor running 8 hours a day.
I understand.
Most residential uses are not going to have a compressor running 8 hours a day. That's just the way it is.
Well, the only two things
are, even though your compressor at home may make as much noise as my commercial compressor, if you run it for 2 hours every other Saturday when you're blowing off your car or painting it or something like that, that's going to be different than being my business running 8 hours a day.
The only two things that they're going to be running is either a generator or an air conditioner. My air conditioner runs in my house 24/7. You know, because it's a heat versus air. It's a heat pump.
That's it. I don't think it's a big issue in it, but like Ivana said, implement some noise abatement. We can probably come up with a standard that is well within the threshold of most, I believe it, 50 dB at the property line or something like that. That's
co-location looks pretty good. Did anybody else?
I wanted to ask you, Ron, we have a representative from the assessor's office here.
Oh, that's who it is.
Dan.
How you doing? I'm Ron.
Dan Wilson from that kind of assessor's office. Okay. And Dan was kind enough to join us to address the issue of property valuations.
Excellent.
And how cell towers might affect them and all that kind of stuff. And Dan, you want to come up to the chair? I'm in the middle. You're a special guest.
Sorry,
Dan.
What about this one? Okay, great.
Is that on the agenda?
Not on the agenda because he didn't know they'd be here.
No.
We're going to modify the agenda because we're nice people. Then he's here.
Okay, well, I'm the chief appraiser right now in charge of appraisal in the county. I've also ran the Board of Property Tax Appeals for the last 5 years. During that time, we've not had a single taxpayer come to us and ask for a reduction in their value due to any type of cell tower or radio tower or any tower whatsoever. We do study things like cell towers along with road noise, views, streams, pretty much anything that you can think of goes into our studies to try to identify whether it's a positive or a negative impact on value on a particular piece of property. We haven't been able to identify any correlation whatsoever negatively or positively for cell towers at this time. And I did look at your study, and I have a similar study from the Appraisal Journal, which is actually the same thing that's referenced there. Their study is a little different because it's more of an urban type study where I could see that maybe having an effect when you have a lot of very similar type houses, you're going to probably choose the house that's not right next to the cell tower if there's many others to choose from. In this more of a rural type community, people are looking for rural type places and we haven't seen a big correlation or any change in value due to the cell tower. So this study in Florida said the results show that while a tower has a statistically significant effect on price of property located near a tower, this effect is minimal. Each geographical location is unique. Residents' perceptions and assessments of risk vary according to a wide range of processing, including psychological, social, institutional, and cultural. And this is for one in Orange County, Florida, which is a very urban type area.
Orlando?
Yep. Okay.
First morning.
Yeah. So right now, we're not valuing a negative or positive impact of cell towers on any property. And this is something that we do look at.
And what I've submitted is three things, actually. An article also from the Appraisal Journal about a study which examines the proximity to a cell phone tower, whether it has an impact on residential property values and the extent of any impact. And they did surveys and market studies and everything, and their conclusion was that cell towers or cellular phone base stations do have a negative impact on the prices of houses. And there's another article where they surveyed all the articles, the studies,
sure,
and they said it's usually between 2% and 20%. And then, just to show you how that, then, whether it affects the appraisal value is also a slightly different question from whether it affects the sales value. You know, like, the appraisal may not change. So here I have, because it was gathered for different purposes, and you like Oregon and local, Kendon Leaf, who's a grants pass, you know, person who says there's absolutely no doubt.
He's a Williams person.
That's right. But he's not a typical Williams person by any means. I mean, well, no, he is. There is no typical Williams, really. So he's a very conservative person who happens to live in Williams. He says, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind or hesitation on my part to publicly say that this tower in any form will greatly reduce property values for the immediately surrounded impacting properties. And then there's Gerald, you probably know him too, Gerald Fitzgerald, local director of the Grants Pass, I think Real Estate Urban Area Planning Commission, American Planning Association.
Is it from 2010?
President. These are, yes, last year, where he said the installation of a cell tower inevitably lowers the value of surrounding properties. And then we have another Oregon one, but it Clackamas, I happen to be back. I'm familiar with the impact that nearby telecommunications antenna facilities may have on a home's marketability. The installation of the proposed telecommunication antenna facility will have an immediate and adverse impact on these neighborhoods. It will significantly impact property values and reduce sales prices immediately. The perceived health and safety risks of such facilities will deter many buyers who would otherwise be interested in purchasing.
To me, that's in direct contradiction to what you're saying.
Yes, and we get a lot of things like this from real estate agents that want to try to give us their opinion, and I would agree that it seems like there should be some type of value reduction for the cell tower, but we got to go by the data. And the data and the sales have never indicated a lowering of value due to it. So I get realtors telling me all the time why we're wrong, but they don't have any data to back up their information.
I have a question for Shivana. Regarding those studies, I heard words like nearby and surrounding and, you know, was there any dimensional standards as part of it? Did they some empirical number they can come up with that says, within this range,
they weren't given
X
here,
number,
you know,
X number of dollars of market devaluation within this next range, we've got a certain percentage or anything like that.
Well, there are the two places where the towns in Houston and what was the other one, I mentioned this last time, the two towns were actually sued by a property owner for allowing a cell tower to be close to their house, and they do give numbers there. One of them was something like $1 million house or $1 million or $2 million. Well, that I don't know. The numbers, it reduced the price supposedly by $25,000.
Can we get the information on that? And find out exactly what happened to that court fees?
Yeah, both cities lost. It's amazing. They got huge settlements.
But I would imagine, and Dan, jump in where we're getting set with us here. Not only the distance, too, but the position of it. You know, I showed you this before, but you know, the position of this cup in the room, the density of it doesn't change. It means a whole lot to me when it's right here.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean anything sitting on the corner. So
which is why we were advocating for large setbacks, because if it's at least a decent distance away, then it's not going
to
affect.
But if the setback happens to be setback away from your front window, that might be perceived as differently than the setback out your back door.
But that, so we can't make a generalized thing. So at least it's a bit out of the
property line.
Mm-hmm. This one is the appraisal institute spotlighted this exact issue of whether it reduces property values, and they educated its members that a cell tower should in fact cause a decrease in home value. Percentage decreases mentioned in the study range from 2 to 20%, with the percentage moving towards the higher range the closer to the property.
I think that would be more of an urban type setting where you're going to have a lot of properties right around the cell tower. These rural type settings where there's one or two large pieces of property close by, it's kind of a different situation.
But that's what we're trying to regulate. How close can the cell tower be to the residents?
We've never seen any type of value that would indicate one way or the other. It's been statistically insignificant.
I'm happy.
Any more questions for Dan?
No, I certainly appreciate you popping in and giving us your factual realizations of what's been happening in the market here, because that definitely helps us.
And I would expect if a homeowner was really thinking that it was affecting their value, they call us and they let us know all the time when they don't think that their value is accurate, and I've never heard somebody come in and complain about it.
But again, let's not confuse appraisal values with market values.
Well, we're appraising for market value.
But these,
not really.
No, we actually, absolutely, we look at all the sales.
Well, everybody in town buys a house knows there's a real value and then there's the assessed value. And that,
sure.
When I bought my home a year ago, I looked at both.
Absolutely.
And when I drove down my lane, I thought, good Lord, how am I going to get cell phone reception here? And I glanced up the top of the hill of Mount Baldy and I go, I'm in. There's cell towers up there. So I bought the house.
Well, see, and that's the other side of the coin. I have customers come to me all the time saying, well, I'm looking at moving up this area. Can I get services to this area? And I tell them, no, they still want to look for somewhere else. It's because where they're at, they can't get any services, so they don't want to buy that piece.
And I look at stuff all the time, and I don't even see them. I mean, they're there.
It's really, you know, you can make arguments on both sides of the fence. You really can.
But we've always agreed that we're not going to stop somebody from getting service. It's just how close the tower is.
Well, actually, you are going to stop people from getting service. There are a lot of people who can't get service. So that there are other mitigating factors as to why people can't get service. So yes, people can be stopped from getting service. So, but you're... For every argument that we say, look, these things can cause the property values to go down, I know for one that the person who enters into the contract with the cell phone company, their property value just went up, because if they sell their property, the contract with the provider goes along with it, so now that property is worth a lot more money. So,
but their neighbors,
you have people who they're not going to buy into an area if they don't have these type of services. You know, and then there are some people that they're not going to buy into the area because those services are there. They want to be out in the
area. Yeah, the guy before me could have gotten into this house and said, oh, look at the ugly tower way up on the top of that mountain. I don't want to buy here.
Yeah.
But you don't look at them. I mean, if you look at them every day, you don't see
them. It's all perspective. And everyone's going to have a different opinion. Everyone's going to have a different perspective. Your point of view is different than my point of view.
I think it's more than perspective. I think it's just the way that the lifestyles are changing.
Mm-hmm.
We come from an analog age where we didn't have things, and our kids aren't going to have that age. It's digital.
Yeah.
And they need digital. That's a fact of life.
Yeah. iPods.
All the schools are going to computers now.
Computers, cell phones.
But they were on the news this morning, Joplin, Missouri. Computer in every backpack. Every kid going back to school in Joplin is getting a brand new computer because they're doing everything on computers, notebooks or anything. So
it's just a fact of life that
the world's changing.
Well, we're cutting down most.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
But there is a difference.
Thank you.
There is.
Right.
The assessed value was not what I was talking about, though. I was talking about the appraised value, which is based on the market value. The assessed value is an arbitrary number created by the state that you get taxed upon, but has nothing to do with the actual appraised value.
Okay.
Cool.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Okay.
Where we at?
Visual impact.
Oh, I loved that thing you guys sent on email where you could run the thing over it and it'd be gone and be there. I played with that for an hour, I swear.
Well, we try to provide entertainment where we can.
Where you can. I mean, you need to make it happy, though, I guess.
And
I guess I forwarded you that site for two reasons. One is to give you examples of some of the stealth power, as they call them.
I like
the still call it stealth towns or advanced.
No, it is. I think it is.
Still called stealth facilities as well as towers themselves. And the other purpose for it was to show what a visual simulation looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. I've seen them for water towers. I've seen them for bridges. I've seen them for wireless facilities and other kinds of utility installations. I think they really help decision makers decide whether that's going to be an impact or not. They help neighbors that are commenting on something. I don't know how much it costs. I'm not certain, and maybe Jim, if you want to chime in at this point.
I'll tell you
what the hassle factor is and cost and that sort of thing, whether that's a standard operating procedure or not.
I'm okay.
Yeah, I think it's fairly standard. The photo simulations that were in the website that I saw are the best that Paul or I've ever seen. And so I'm guessing those are more expensive than usual. The ones we provide are terrific. Maybe they show you what it looks like with and without the new facility. It's usually $1,000 to produce high quality photo simulations. But yes, those are not unusual parts of an application that we would submit.
You said they're not usual or not unusual?
Not unusual. I'm not saying everybody requires them, or each jurisdiction, we require every type of classification or new structure. But we do see those; they're fairly common. And as people get more and more savvy with showing simulations of our proposed installations from different angles, they take pictures and they do the computer graphics. That's definitely something we can provide to show you how the site will blend or not blend in with the from a particular angle.
Okay. And one of the things from a staff standpoint and thinking about when are we going to require this? Well, if we're going to require them, when are we going to require them? Will it be every time? Will it be for a ministerial application? Will it be for a full site plan approval? Quasi-judicial, that's where I'm leaning. Because I don't want to necessarily require them for co-locations. But for a new facility, I think that's probably a good idea. And then, do we want it related to, and I'm throwing the question out to the subcommittee, do we want to relate that to density standard applications where we've got public concern that's part of a notes to the file, people are writing in, raising issues like property values being affected or some other issue, and this is a way to help answer that question.
And I'd like to ask, to me, density doesn't make sense.
How fast can one of these things be turned around? Jim, any idea when you say order a visual simulation, how fast do you get it?
I would say typically about 2 weeks. 2 to 3 weeks, so they actually have to get in. They have to make sure that they have the proper photos. Sometimes we have them available, sometimes we don't. Usually we have the latest photos available. And then it takes them usually probably a week and a half to do their magic and get it back to them.
Okay. Even in Southern Oregon?
Even in Southern Oregon, yes, sir.
We're not in Tobin, so.
But that, I think you're right. I think if someone's come in and then they're doing an application for tower and the people in the general area that have some sort of an issue with it, then they should be required to put something like this in and say, look, we still want to put our tower in. This is what we're going to do to make it where it's going to be pleasing for everyone to look at. That way, we're going to do our part and see what they say. And if the people putting the tower in have an issue with that, then you can find a location with it.
So we can go look at our ordinance again. We can go to all the timer requirements or some types of applications requirements. We can tie it to density. We can make it, we can make it development standards by zoning district or in the site plan approval criteria.
But this is, when are you going to require this?
Well, I think it's to the applicant's benefit to do this.
It would be.
Yeah, certainly if they presented that this is what it's going to look like, they're going to have a lot less arguments against.
If it's a, and then if the committee will look at maybe 99090, which is your wireless facility site plan approval criteria, again, that's for a quasi-judicial decision, new facility, and
remember, we've done a basic separation in this ordinance between objective standards and subjective criterion or criteria. General development standards of, what's the number again?
General or objective?
The general development standards of 060
objective.
Are objective.
060.
And then 090 are the subject.
The reference.
090.
So are the
subjective
criteria.
Right. Wireless facility site plan approval criteria are the subjective criteria that you must meet a threshold, and that's up to the decision maker, whether it be planning director or a planning commission, to decide whether you satisfy that criteria.
So you're asking
if we put it in, and remember the automatic triggers that we have, because if you're a ministerial application, co-location or anything else, you're going to be subject to 6-0.
But not the.
But if we don't want to require it for every co-location, we just want it for new facilities, I think it's better to put it in 090.
Yeah, we don't need it for co-location.
You don't really need it for co-location.
Right. I think that's pretty done.
Okay. James, I'm going to work on some language and put it in the next draft.
Okay. That sounds like an excellent movement forward.
There's a quarter after four.
That'll cover that setbacks. Setback maps. Do we have any maps?
Oh, yeah.
Ann has news for us.
I do?
Yes. We have no setback maps.
Do you want her to give us the news?
I have news. I didn't know I had news. If that is exactly right, we have no new setback map.
What we had hoped to do from our GIS folks was to take this particular map and split that into three different maps or four different maps. What were the setbacks again?
2,500. No, 250, 750, and 1,500, which
right.
is what the
split three
that we
three
used.
Big categories to kind of see how those looked. Coverage-wise, they're actually represented on this map, but because we tried to put five different standards in here, it's really confusing. Guys, I don't know if you've seen this map before.
I am.
Please look in your eyes.
Yeah.
anyway, this represents, James, help me out here.
The 250 is the light blue.
Yeah.
And then I think the
500.
The 750 is kind of the salmon color, and then the 1500 he did not put on this one. The 750 is the largest one out that he had. No, 1500 is your dark green.
Dark green. So it's actually on this map, but because they're so tight together, we asked Cody to give us three different maps showing us those thresholds. We don't have the maps.
Yeah, you could go across and look at that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or
and those three thresholds are the three that we use the most. The 250, I believe, is for residential. The 750 is for farm and forest, and the 1500 is for comp plan zone changes and also our, you know, mining sites.
What she's talking about are notifications of land use applications. So if we're talking about setbacks, Anne's talking about notification areas of
right.
That's how you have this information because they relate to these other things.
Yes.
So differences relate
exactly.
to that.
Yeah.
Right.
It's handy when we go with that because
mm-hmm.
anyone who's going to be affected because they happen to be within a setback range would also
mm-hmm.
get noticed. So
mm-hmm.
if we tie the two together, that
mm-hmm.
makes a lot of sense for us.
So I do want to bring to the attention, and I handed this out probably two meetings ago, so who knows where it is in your paperwork. After the first time we had another setback discussion, the CAC got together again, and we were thinking, okay, given the raised issues, what would be our different proposal, raised setbacks, compromise proposal, taking all the issues into consideration. So we never did discuss that. We did hand this out. It's a one-page thing that just says setbacks.
Two meetings ago, I would say two meetings ago.
It's just the last one needs better verbiage, but it was just after the discussion here, after talking to
could you put whatever the two meeting ago date was, and then put today's date on that before you get to talking? Right on there. Yeah.
So we did it.
July 1st.
We met July 1st and July 6th.
Is it July 1st then you want the date
July
on there?
July 1st.
Okay.
And then just put today's date on it. Discuss.
Yeah. So it was after our discussion and then after getting the information from how Lane County is doing it, how are the people who had 1,500, for example, you know, and we're willing to compromise with that. But how are they handling it and finding out that Lane County has the waivers that we had originally talked about that property owners can sign off and that the other one, they still have the thing that...
There were a couple of those on that list that had no setbacks at all. I mean, you're only mentioning Lane County with the 1,500.
Yeah,
there were some that had none at all.
1,200. Lane County's 1,200. It wasn't.
There were 1,200, but there were some that had none at all.
Yeah, well, that's not. Well, we're trying to compromise.
Well,
down. Shabana has a photo effect down. Oh, that's right. She printed it in that funny print. That is exactly what it's
comic fans.
Okay. Remember there was one that came out in some funny print,
mm-hmm.
even though I didn't submit it that way. But it's good for entertainment. It's
called Comic Sans.
Give them back.
Yes.
Okay. You didn't get that yet?
So I don't know if we want to go there today just because it's such an exhausting topic. But
We're talking about 1,200 now because we're trying to compromise.
Did you all think, just as a side thing, did you all see the latest?
Issue on the table. Do you want to move on it, or do you want to put it off the next meeting, or do you want to
put it off as long as
possible?
Setback max, since we covered them, we have decision matrix is next. Let's do the decision matrix, what we're going to do on that first, and then make a determination to continue with our agenda.
Okay.
And then if we want to tackle that a little bit. So, decision matrix, Dave passed out a little block diagram of how they do things with the planning office.
The black box of the planning office. Here you go. Start at the top and work your way to the bottom. First thing we would take through the ordinance is it applicable? Or is it an exemption? It's the first decision we make on any land use application where we have exemptions. We're taking a pre-app submittal. That has a $375 permit fee with it.
And is there any notification with a pre-app in general?
No. To agencies.
Agencies only. Not to.
For 75.
What about CAC? This is the only two that there are.
Yes.
If they're involved with the property or in the that property falls within that CAC area.
As mapped, yes.
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 You'll let them know.
Then
the pre-app.
Agency is, yes.
Mm-hmm. We have two applicant lawyers, right?
Yes. That's
two recognized CACs.
Two recognized ones.
So you've got $375. We do pre-apps generally within 4 to 6 weeks max. We're usually kicking them out in about 4 weeks. So that is a, and for those of you that aren't familiar with the land use process, pre-application is just that. It's not an application per se. There's not a quote-unquote land use decision that comes out of a pre-app. It's an advisory set of notes that we give an applicant that helps them file the real application, whether it be ministerial, quasi-judicial, or legislative. The pre-app
here is a little different than most other jurisdictions. Most jurisdictions have a pre-op conference. So somebody gives you materials. It's usually a site map, a vicinity map, a depiction of the project, usually a narrative, a fee that goes with it. That gets distributed internally to Public Works, planning, building, a fire marshal, sometimes another agency within the county or city. Also goes out to other state agencies that may be affected. Department of State Lands, DEQ, Division of Water Resources, ODFW, Department of Forestry, other agencies that might be affected. They can either submit their comments to the county, which would include that in the pre-op conference summary. Sometimes a conference takes place. In most jurisdictions, it does. This jurisdiction generally doesn't do a conference, but we do it if someone asks for it. So if TAS was going to file an application, you had a tough site, you knew it was going to be a tough site, you know there's issues, you want to sit down and have the notes from the fire marshal in your hand, the notes from Department of Forestry in your hands, you want to talk to the planners and talk to the public works because you got an access issue, let's say, here's your chance to do it. For $375, probably the best money you ever spent. Most of all, because it helps scope their project. What are the issues? Do they need a geotech? Do they need a structural engineer? Do they need a whatever? In this case, it might be our time to tell them independent RF review is going to be required of this one. Or whatever kind of standard that's in this ordinance, especially being a new ordinance, I would imagine when people apply for those pre-apps, the first few that we get, 5 or 10 of them, they're going to ask for a conference. Almost guaranteed. And we grant that for no extra cost.
I think you're right. I think had we done that on the last one that we did with AT&T, I think my understanding of how everything worked would have been a lot better. I think it would have been
regardless of whether we do a conference or not, James and the other planners will write up a pre-application summary. We send that out 4 to 6 weeks. Lays out, here's what you got to do. Oftentimes, what they've given us for pre-app, and we get varying levels of materials. We get engineered, CAD drawn, two scale, Cadillac plans, and we get something in the back of a napkin too. And we're trying to raise the bar a bit, but we're not there yet. So, part of what we're trying to get them to use white napkins right now. Part of what we're trying to do is to make sure that we've got good information coming in, and sometimes the pre-app goes back to them and says, what you gave us for a pre-app is adequate. We just need the following 2 or 3 items, and you're good to go with your application. Fill out the form, pay the application fee, and resubmit.
What is the current application fee?
We have no application fee for this right now.
For this review, as of today, right now, we charge two fees. You gave a site review fee and a conditional use fee.
Right.
Yeah.
$4,000.
Whoa, holy cow. Wait a second. Say that again. The site review is how much?
$2,000. And the conditional use permit fee is
$2,000. Why is it so high?
We got two different reviews that we're doing. We're doing the conditional use permit review, and then we're doing on-site visitation and public notice and all that. Mm-hmm. These fees are kind of carrying over on a policy that the previous director had done.
Now, weren't all these fees just looked at by LUBA? Didn't they do a fee schedule review? I know they did in Jackson County.
LUBA did look at the county fee schedule in response to an appeal that was filed by Rogue Advocates. We did get a remand on that, but it only covered about 1 year worth of fees on particular kinds of applications. In a grander sense, not something that the subcommittee will deal with. Ron will deal with it as a PC member. Because development fees in the state of Oregon are seen as a land use decision,
it will go to the Planning Commission. Vivian will see it too. Sorry. You'll see this as a land use decision that comes to the Planning Commission with our fee schedule as proposed. What we're supposed to do by statute is charge the average development review fee or the real cost development review fee. There are advantages and disadvantages to both. And I guess I won't elaborate on that. But anyway, part of what we're doing in the next few months is looking at our fee schedule, especially since we're pulling in a new fee. It will be an opportune time for us. So by the time this ordinance subcommittee's done their work, we're ready to go to hearing on it. Hopefully side by side with that, we can look at our fee ordinance and how we're going to fold this one in. It may have its own standalone fee. Frankly, I'd rather go there. Mm-hmm. A standalone fee for rentals. Mm-hmm. Co-location, this new wireless facility is this. And I'm not in favor of the way our fee structure is currently covered, which is a stacking of fees. I just don't like that method. Anyway, so we'll charge a fee when they apply. After we've made a decision on the process, and back to my drawing here again.
Process meaning whether it goes ministerial, whether it goes quite efficient. And how long does the pre-app, doesn't it expire at a certain point? They have to do another one?
Pre-applications are good for
1 year.
1 year. And again, they are not, they don't vest you to anything. You can have an ordinance 4 months from now that changes. In fact, James could get a pre-application in tomorrow for a wireless facility under the current code, which is site plan review, conditional use, because we don't have an ordinance. You folks pass, and he sends out his pre-app notes. They sit on it. They do their lease negotiations. They're talking to the property owner. By November, we pass an ordinance, and it's effective 90 days hence. It's effective by February. They come walking in April and say, okay, James, we're ready to apply for our conditional use in our site plan. James tells them we have no ordinance and you have to comply with it.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, just so in case anybody's caught in that, send them a letter.
Yeah. It doesn't, and in this case, there'll be few and far between. The wireless industry obviously is going to know what's going on. But the pre-op notes are good for a year. Because they're not an actual application, they don't vest. What we do is we want to be updating the information we're giving to people. So if you did a pre-app, and more than a year goes by, we want the opportunity to tell you what the new standards are and go from there. So that's what they're good for a year. Mm-hmm. So we make a decision on the process. We go to ministerial or quasi-judicial.
What divides that? I missed that part of the conversation. Is there a two-liner that can tell me that?
Yeah, there's a one-liner that can tell you that. 99040. What I didn't do with this, and I apologize, is, I can amend this and send it back to you, is I was doing this at the same time I was rejumbling the numbers on your ordinance, so we can redraw this with the ordinance sections in there so you know what's actually applied at that time.
Right.
Which answers your question, I think. So, we're now at 040, ministerial or judicial. In review types, we picked one. That dictates what our application requirements are. All of them will be subject to general development standards and zoning district standards. And may need to make an adjustment to ministerial to make a reference to zoning standards.
That's 99 for those.
Hey, can you make a note of that?
Do what? What note do you?
Under that, that is a reference to zoning district standards needed for ministerial applications.
sections in the past. In addition, you would have to have another section.
Yeah. Under 040. Just mark. Zone standards. I did not include that in the main detail. So after we've looked at general development standards and zoning district standards, I split it out again because ministerial and quasi-judicial, we've listed the kind of requirements that they have. There are particular requirements for co-location, spelling that, and temporary requirements. Under quasi-judicial, there's the RF engineer, the site plan approval criteria apply, and there's a public notice period. Once we're through that, we're ready to make a decision, issue a permit with conditions, or it doesn't meet the standard, and we deny it. Under this ordinance, I have not run through the ORS to see if there's any kind of exemption. I don't believe there is. I believe this qualifies as a limited land use decision, ministerial, quasi-judicial. The application of standards, it's not changing the legislative. I've adopted the ordinance well, but the permit under this will qualify as a limited land use decision in the state statute, unless I see an exemption that I haven't found yet. That means it's subject to the 150-day rule. For those of you that aren't planning commission members or haven't dealt with this before, 150-day rule is when we get a limited land use decision application that comes in, we have 30 days to call it complete. I'm going to make this real basic. There's some other factors that come into play. Here's our app. This is beyond the pre-app. We're now filing an application. The applicable statute is ORS 215-427. The application is made on day one. In 30 days, James is going to take in that application, delegate it again. He's going to review it against the application requirements, and he's going to determine whether the application is complete. Technically complete.
This is my 30-day notice that I sent out to people. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And then within 30 days, I send them a letter. Deeming the application, this one was completed.
Right. If it is not completed, now it gets fun.
Mm.
We send out our letter by this day. Usually sooner, but at least by 30 days we send it out. So we deem it complete. If the letter says, and we call that a TC letter, technically complete. If it is not technically complete, then we list for the applicant.
What's not complete?
You spell out what's not complete. What they need to do to make it complete.
And how much time do they have to do that?
Good question. We send out that letter, and the applicant from that point forward has to tell us, yes, I'm going to submit the application, or the information you're after, and here it is. And that becomes, let's say that's another 15 days. Doesn't have to be, but it could be. About 15 days, they send it out, and they are now complete. So 45 days from the very beginning, in this case, they are now complete, and that's with information.
But if they don't complete 1, 2, and 3, they've got 180 days to complete 1, 2, and 3?
I'm getting there.
Okay.
Yeah. They can also send James a letter that says, I'm not going to give it to you. I don't think I have to. I'm going to do it. At that point, we deem them complete. The terms of processing. Are they substantively complete? Can we necessarily approve their application? Maybe not.
But for purposes of this ORS, they are complete. They are deemed technically complete. Ask them for the information, not going to give it to you. We have to process. We have to process an application. And it's the applicant's choice on whether he wants to do that or not. We've asked for a traffic study, we've asked for a geotechnical analysis, we've asked for something to help substantiate what they want to do in their application. And they say, oh, I'm not going to do it. Now, where the applicant's going to get themselves in trouble is if we tell them something that is meets one of these general development standards or one of these site plan approval criteria, and they choose not to give it. When we get that letter back, we may very well know what the answer is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to deny the application. In some cases, it may be something we can condition an application to meet before construction, before occupancy, something like that. But the applicant does have the option to say, no, I'm not giving it to you. And if he does that, let's say he does it within 5 days, no. Not done. Then that's when he's complete.
Isn't there any warning when you were sending that list that says if you don't do these things that are required by code, then you probably won't get it approved?
Not really. Remember, these applications come after the pre-app. So the pre-app pretty much lays out, here's what you need to do to file a complete application,
mm-hmm.
a technical complete application. Most folks are just going to do it. A few don't. Sometimes, you know, you can lead the horse to water. From these dates that I've circled, no, they're not going to. Or yes, they do within 15 days. Whatever that date may be, that's the 150-day clock.
So what's the 180-day clock?
In an urban jurisdiction, that's 120 days.
Mm-hmm.
We have to make a decision, and that clock's on us. So James has to make a decision within 150 days, including appeal periods, to approve with conditions, to deny. And then for those applications, that's why sometimes as planning commission members, you're going to get something on a docket, and we may not have time for a continuance. We need a decision.
Right, and we've had those before, and we've had,
right.
We basically said, look, applicant, do you want to extend your 150-day time frame, or do you want us to make a decision which might not be favorable to you at this point?
Right.
And the applicant has the authority to say, okay, I'll extend it. We don't.
Right.
We cannot extend it.
Good point. And I wanted to cover that before you get to 180. The applicant has the choice on whether they want to continue it. They may get a staff report right here on a quasi-judicial decision that says, you've got problems. You didn't give us that traffic study or that geotechnical report or the visual simulation that we asked for. And because you didn't, we find you don't meet the ordinance, and we're going to recommend denial. And they go, oh, wait a minute. Okay, I guess that wasn't a bad idea after all. I'll go do it. And we're telling them, hey, you're at day 137, and we're recommending, you know, our recommendation is for denial. And they say, I want that done. What do I do?
Mm-hmm. And what is the process that they do? Just ask, and you give it?
Yeah, in writing. In writing, they can extend it. They can extend the hearing. And you'll hear this at a planning commission hearing. The applicant will say, we request a continuance. You know, the planning commission is obviously, you know, heading toward a denial. We want to address your concerns. We ask for a continuance of 30 days to come back to you with the information, and we extend the 150-day clock on 30 days as well. Where this does not apply are on comp plan zone changes. If you're changing the comp plan, it doesn't apply. In some jurisdictions, you can do zone changes within comp plan designations, and it does. But in this jurisdiction, we're called a one-map system. The comp plan is the same as the zone change, as the zoning map. And therefore, if you're changing the zone map, you're changing the comp plan, and the 150 days doesn't apply. Now on to 180. The statute says you have 180 days to perfect your application. Otherwise, your application is void. So, we talked about how long can they take to get the information in. James gets out his letter on day 30. They receive it, and he tells them what to do. They don't respond, or they say, yeah, I'll get something back to you. But they never do. And the clock ticks out to day 180. And they don't give it to us. I can declare their application void.
Okay, and they would have to reapply.
Yes.
And just a quick highlight.
Typically, if somebody got out here and said, my engineer is stalling on me, we had to reengineer the project, blah, blah, blah. We're not going to void an application until we got a pretty good reason to. But if we told them back here and they just said, they went away, never returned a phone call, whatever, dropped the project, there's no reason to keep it in the office because this clock, we told them. Mm-hmm. So we don't want to get a mandamus action if we don't meet our 150 days. So
there are times when it's best to just void the application.
Sure. There is people in this community, and I mean, you haven't even really seen it yet, and what they will do is they'll come to the hearing. And they'll be under the 150-day rules, but they'll try and bring up all this crap to tell them what's wrong with the application, and then in the exact same breath, bitch about not making 150 days. So there is a segment of bodies out there that I'm not going to get into their understanding and why they do that, but they're playing both edges of the sword with the two faces and trying to slog the process down. All I see is they're doing. They're not achieving any end result of it and aggravating everybody in the process.
We have a cleaner process now, I believe, in making sure that our QC letter goes out, that it really lays out what needs to be in the application. And, the department was not in the habit of doing that on all applications in the past. We do it now. So it's much cleaner. And I think our 150-day check, lots of stuff, we're putting in those staff reports now, when the 150-day is up. Identify what that 150-day decision is. And any additional thoughts on...
Once the application is complete, the planner brings the information to me. I do draw the maps up. I draw the names of the surrounding neighborhood, whether, like I said before, whether it's 250 in residential, 750 in rural, and 1,500 for comp plan zone changes, mining quarry, things like that. And then I will compile the mailing list. I'll put together the maps. I'll put together all the noticing. And then it's approved by either David or the planner, whoever is, or both of them. And then once it's approved, then it comes back to me, and I put out all the noticing. The noticing has to be done 22 days before the initial hearing, or 22 days at least to give them, time to... whether they want to comment on it or whatever.
It's a public comment.
Yeah. And then once that time passes, either then the decision is made or we go to hearing, however that is. And then once the hearing is done, then the decision, the findings are done, then another notice of decision has to go out on all the findings. And we have to include all the people who have appeared or written in on comments and everything.
Most jurisdictions have a hearings officer that does it. Same role as the planning commission, one person rather than seven, or in your case nine. this jurisdiction allows the planning director to make quasi-judicial decisions, which includes subjective criteria. And I can't make a decision until that public notice and comment period is over.
Right.
I can't jump the gun, make a decision fast because, you know, I'm going on vacation and Dan's going to be out of office and he's going to just make the call by Thursday. It doesn't work that way.
So when
people, sometimes they get frustrated with, what do you mean you can't make a decision until then? I've got everything right in front of you. Well, we've got to send out a notice, notify the public within that radius. Mm-hmm. We have to wait for their comments to get back, wait for our agency comments to get back. Mm-hmm. Then we collect all that, make a decision, send it out, and there's an appeal period.
Right. So when the decision is made, the findings, you know, and however it's done, planning director or planning commission, then the findings are done, and that was something that has caused problems in the past. We like to have the findings within at least a 2-week time frame because we're still running in that 150-day time frame because any planning decision, director decision is subject to appeal to, you know, just as everything else. It goes right to the board. And then the planning commission, it goes right to the board. So you have, when you do the appeal, then you have to set the hearing for the appeal. You have another 22-day noticing period in which to get, you know, notify everybody of that hearing. The hearing's held. So if it goes, the crucial time is when it goes to the planning commission. We have that first 22 days. So you're already on your clock, 150. So you've got 22 out of that 150. You set the hearing. You've got all of that time frame in there. If they don't continue it, they make a decision, it's appealed. You have another 22 days for the appeal hearing. You have to hold the appeal hearing, and then that has to have decisions and findings and all of that, all within the 150 days. So you're really on the clock.
Unless they ask for a longer period.
Unless they ask for a longer period. Right. And that can move that.
When you get public comments before the initial decision, does it always go to a hearing, a public hearing?
No.
But it is factored into the decision, whether it's by the planning director or the planning commission.
So it might just be public comments, and then the planning department makes the initial decision.
Part of what the RLDC gives me the ability to do is to pick the hearing body. I can pick the hearing body.
When do you do a hearing, though? Do you pick also when you want a hearing?
I pick who it's going to. And then I'll get to a minute how we can do the scheduling for hearing. But one of the things that the Rural Land Development Code gives the planning director the authority to do is decide who's going to hear it. So if it comes in, it's a quasi-judicial decision, and during that first public notice period that goes out, where we notify, whether it be for pre-app or whether it be for the actual application usually when it comes in, let's say Cass has got a tower application coming in. It's in Shivana's backyard. It's 251 feet. Steve Williams is calling the other day. And
they're yelling over the fence.
35 letters come into the planning office objecting, raising concerns. Oh my gosh, there's an endangered mushroom out there. We got all this stuff going on. I'm going to bump it up to the planning commission.
Oh,
that's
thanks.
One of the choices I made. I'm going to Nick Bidley to make the decision. So,
really?
And I do have some criteria that tell me when to do that. So if it's an issue of broad public interest, 35 letters on Wayne's application, that's what I consider broad. If they all come from the same person, no.
What if they come from the same town?
Maybe.
Is that a problem? I'm curious. Pick up in the same. So, well, actually, the thing is, of course, they're going to come from the same town. You know, where
all of their last names are Shavon.
Yeah, that's never.
That's put them all on the light table, and they're the same letter signed by 35 different people.
Right, right.
Maybe not, but and their cousins and whatever. No, and that is a decision that I have to make. Which body does it go to? Typically. If it's a ministerial decision and it goes to staff, that's it. It's a staff level decision, fairly quick, and that's why we do ministerial decisions. Quasi-judicial in this jurisdiction, most of the of the calls get made by the planning director. But if it's got a broad public interest,
if it has controversial, if it's happening right next to a wild and scenic area, would be something where federal agencies now get involved, or it involves a couple of state agencies like Dogami, DEQ, and DSL because of bridge crossing or an excavation of mining materials in a riparian area, something like that, that'll bump up a level. A mine with blasting, probably go to the planning commission.
Question for
you. We've got one that we just did, Chancellor Quarry, which is ODOT's quarry up on behind the rest area up there in I-5, going to the planning commission.
Now once you do get the permit with conditions, is there a time limit on completion of the project? Do you have 180 days, 6 months from the time that the permit's given until the actual project's 2 years?
A 2 year time limit on when you do that.
2 year
yeah,
time
with, and you can get a 2 year extension.
And you get 2 year extension.
So
right.
4 actually.
Right. And we've just this is sort of spot with me today, but because I just went through a board hearing today. We, in response to the downturn in the economy, some people had asked that their site plan approvals, conditional use permit approvals, would be extended for an additional 2 years beyond that. And we responded to that. The board wanted to see that. They were focused on conditional use permits. We broadened that to all site plan approvals and development permits. So because of the economy, people had projects in the pipeline. All of a sudden, they couldn't fund them. They couldn't get financing, you know, whatever, a bunch of reasons. So they decided to make that extension beyond that. So that's, we have an answer for you, but that answer's probably going to change in the next 2 months. So it'll be a longer time frame.
Or if it should just be open end, you can do anything you want to do it. Instead of having a time frame.
I just want to make one point on this. The ORS 215-427, now that's Oregon law, specific to cell towers. The FCC came down in and made some of the time limits in the United States Code about how quickly jurisdictions has to turn around cell tower applications. They actually looked at ORS 215 in Oregon, and they actually used it. So for a brand new tower, it's just like this, 150 days. For the change here is co-locations, we have to turn around in 90 days. I just want to make that clear.
It shouldn't take 90 days to do a co-location.
No. No.
I have a question.
It takes longer for you to say what you're trying to do.
My question is at any time during this process, does anyone tell the applicant that they can request more time for this, and that's in the law that they can do it? Has anyone ever informed them of that? So I'm sure not every applicant sits around and reads Oregon state law.
You know, we've brought it up.
Most applicants are in a hurry, so it usually doesn't come up.
Mm-hmm. So the answer is no.
I'm trying to think of whether we say that in the 30-day TC letter.
I don't believe it's in the 30-day TC
letter. There is a paragraph that usually is in our pre-appointments about that.
And then the Planning Commission, I know that whenever they've had a hearing, and I've been at enough of them to where the planner at the time, when they know they're on that wire, they will mention to the chair at the Planning Commission hearing that, you know, we're on the 150-day deadline, we're pushing it, we would request that if you do this, this, or this, that the applicant, you know, does have the option of extending the time so that we will be inside that time frame. And I know that Ron has had, you know, been present at many of those hearings where we've had that come up.
I haven't had an applicant ever say I never knew about the 150 days.
Yeah, well, we've also had instances where we bumped up both the Planning Commission and the BCC, and there's been one or two cases where we've actually met together to make it under that 150 days.
Right. So, but in terms of that, I think, Vivian, what you're asking is,
is the applicant aware that they've got the ability to push that out?
Yeah.
Because if we don't make 150 days, the onus is on us. I'm going to tell them.
Mm-hmm.
You bet. I'll tell them every time. And we'll tell them, look, we have to make a decision in 150 days.
But you can.
We didn't get the information from your engineer, so this isn't looking good. But if you want to extend more time, we'll push our process out, and that'll give you time to get
there. Have to give something in writing asking for more time?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is that included in any current letters that you send out to them? You said it was in the pre-op. Something.
I believe there's reference to the 150-day thing in the pre-op.
It doesn't have to be in writing at the PC either. If they come up to the hearing, just request it. We can create that.
And it's, in the record at that time.
To do it, but it's in the record.
I'm just looking for, you know, some clarification for an applicant that doesn't know they can push it out. And they're scrambling around, you know, their kids aren't eating because they're too worried about this, their chickens don't get fed, whatever, because they're scurrying around trying to make this 150 days, when they could do it, when they could ask for an additional 60 days,
yeah.
And it would be more comfortable for them.
Yeah.
And they should know that up front so that they
I don't think it's an issue.
Can do that.
I haven't seen it come up that way. I mean, usually by the time they file, they're in a hurry. They want it to happen.
How about to Osage Vivian?
Yeah.
Can we just put a note in the pre-op application that this is available?
Okay. That's on a general planning commission.
Like you said, when we put our app in, we're calling them, saying, what else do you need, what else do you need, what else do you need?
Mm-hmm.
And more often than not, the person who's got the app is going to contact and be on the ball. You know, unless they want to just mess with the planning department, like I'm sure you.
Well, there have been savvy people in the past who know very aware of that 150 days and will drag it out just so that they can do the mandamus. That has happened, and we've seen that happen. So they're very aware of that. Some who are in the community are very aware of that and will push them out.
They will be down at the courthouse on day 151.
Exactly.
We're 5 minutes to 5, and you had a hand raised behind the door.
Hi, so we had an application issue. I just called down here and said, James, I know you need this information. I haven't got it. We're almost out of time. What do I do? And he just submitted it in writing. So there are easy to get on the phone and answer when people were stressed on an application.
Yeah, it's never been an issue in my time here.
Yeah, I guess you just have to rely on the fact that good planning staff aren't interested in denying people simply because they ran out of time.
Okay.
And we just don't do that.
Thank you.
Okay. Other matters from committee members? I know we want to get back to setbacks, but we're not going to do that today, obviously. So
maybe just for our record, we should note on the bottom of this, which says discuss 817, that it was postponed to the
17th. I still have it in my.
Mm-hmm.
I have the original one.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
We'll put that back on the agenda.
Put it on the agenda for the next meeting.
And then what I will do, I guess, for the next meeting is just reconcile all the things. You've probably, hopefully, already done this. Reconcile all the things we've submitted with this version.
I can come in.
Okay, cool. So I'll just
okay.
Go over that.
There was enough material in the last two meetings that I have a lot of comments in this new version. And I think I'm there, but
okay. If
you want to look at it,
scrutinize
it
again. And this was for Vivian. I know you were not here when at the beginning of the meeting. This is the outline that you had requested as to the order of where they are within the ordinance.
Oh, okay.
And David had put that together, and this is, I think, along the lines or something that you had kind of.
I took your list and someone else's list, and so I consolidated and came up with it. But that's your cheat sheet, so you go to stuff quick.
Do we want to put on the agenda for next time? I don't know what's been because I haven't read this yet. Remember we were talking about a list of preferences. Number one clearly is co-location on the same support structure.
Right.
You know. Number two is locating on the same site where there's already
mm-hmm.
antennas. Number three was commercial industrial zones. Have we Have we put that anywhere? Or do we want to bring that up as an agenda item for next time? To
so
really look at overall...
Co-location at the same structure, co-location, same site, and co-location commercial, is that what
no, you're... not the third one is not co-location commercial. The third one is
okay.
Now it's a new tower, because we can't, there is no
okay.
co-location. So new tower in commercial or industrial,
okay.
And then maybe forest, and then maybe others, or something like that. Do we want to have an overarching priority? I think we said we did. But we didn't have it in there yet. So it could be an agenda.
Take a look at this, at 99090. And look at the, actually, look at a 1, 2, and 3.
A, 1, 2, and 3?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sort of the introductory statements of each of those.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they have subcategories or sub requirements under them.
Okay.
But I kind of took that concept and put it into the site plan approval criteria.
Okay, so
in other words, a new facility shall not be authorized unless you first demonstrate that the existing support structures are not up to it. Then you have to justify the need to location. Then you have to meet the site criteria for that.
But within what you just said, it doesn't say you also, then if you can't put it on the same tower, then you look at putting it at the same site. And if you can't put it at the same site, then you look at industrial commercial.
Let's put that on an agenda.
So
yeah,
that's
what I'm
saying. Put it on an agenda. And see if it satisfies. What you think.
Yeah, I'll read that.
But
yeah, let's put it on the agenda.
Put it on the agenda, and we'll talk about it when we have the tiering concept that we're talking about. That's where I put it in. I may not have addressed all your issues, but maybe
I had a comment.
Sure.
I was going to be late, and I was late already for this meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And when I call in, I get a recording that says, oh, we're closed now, or please plug in the, or touch on in, whatever, the extension you want to reach. I don't have a list of extensions here, so I don't know how to reach anybody.
Okay.
And so, James, you're going to find the funniest message on your phone because...
We're done with Jim.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Jim?
No. Jim?
He's done with us, too.
Jim, are you gone?
He's gone.
Okay.
Okay. You're going to find the funniest on your phone. Yeah.
Okay.
So, okay. You're probably in the meeting, and you probably won't get the celebrity, but I'm late.
So
you know, this is a traffic call. But there should be some way to notify you guys.
You missed that all together.
And I don't know what to do when I'm on the way and I'm going to be here and want to be counted.
Just the people you need to call are all sitting here in the room. We're not at our extent.
Yeah, but there's someone out there, you know, that isn't in this meeting,
well,
they can duck their head in and say, hey, she's on the way. And that's another thing, you know, that kind of bugs me as a taxpayer and as a just a regular person out there is that, you know, your city county offices should be available to everybody, you know, at least 8 to 5 Monday through Friday, and you guys close. And I know part of it is because you have a small staff and you're out in the field and et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, what I find amusing is that people actually close for lunch here. And usually people overlap their hours where I've come from so that someone is always available to the public. So it's a public enemy. And it, you know, it's the...
Already have this conversation with the commissioners, and if you want to be different, I encourage you to have them.
Oh, you did?
No. It's before my time.
It's been 4 or 5 times now.
Right. And it is a staffing issue, and the amount of bodies that we've got to throw out.
When they cut the staff, it went down.
Yeah. And just, that's what it's going to be.
How many staff do you have in planning?
6.
We've got 6, and we've got 3 people that can answer questions at the front end.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, I'd volunteer, but I probably would not answer the question.
Yeah.
Anything else? We have a next meeting set?
We don't have a date.
Okay.
I thought it was the 29th.
No, the 20. Oh, for Planning Commission hearing?
No.
No, we. The 29th is the Planning Commission hearing. August 29th is the Planning Commission hearing.
Wednesday would be the BCC date, so.
Okay, so the next one is September 7th.
No, for the subcommittee here?
Yeah.
In May 2002.
We have not. No,
we haven't decided on a date for now.
We're going to send it out.
It's not on that calendar. Yeah. 21st?
21?
No, 7th, the 21st?
I like it.
3 o'clock?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I realize, although Steve Williams has been here every single meeting, I did not, none of us notified him about the change, so I'll notify him about it.
I may have a contact with.
And I'm not going to be available for the next, from the 24th through the at least September 5th, possibly the 7th. So I'll be out of state. So I won't be able to attend any meetings that are being held.
It's good production today. I like it.
Are we done?
We're done. Okay.